It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
In my opinion, it's also a huge PR risk because if he gets out of a car that he's really comfortable with, the RB21 is a much more difficult car to drive. So what if he gets P20 on the grid in front of his home fans?
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. There's a famous saying, in F1, you're either giving pain or taking it. And after just two rounds of this World Championship, there are plenty of examples of that for us to discuss. We're going to dig into what's gone wrong for Liam Lawson and why he will no longer be Max Verstappen's teammate at the next round in Suzuka. We're going to get into Oscar Piastri's complete weekend, Norris's will they or won't they break dramas, and where Ferrari go from here after a sprint win and a double disqualification. George Russell keeps up the scoreboard pressure, and his rookie teammate is no slouch either. And what about the four license points that don't make prizes for Jack Doohan? And we're going to say goodbye to the inimitable Eddie Jordan. That's all coming up in this podcast. With me to discuss this and more, we have two of our top F1 writers. Fresh off the plane from Shanghai, Ronald Vording. How's it going?
Yeah, good, except for a little jet lag, but yeah, can't complain. Has been a very, very interesting weekend. So
there's no time for jet lag, Ronald. There's so much to do.
I know.
And here in London is Jake Boxall-Legg. How are you going, Jake?
Good, thanks. I'm about to have my own dose of jet lag soon as I'm off to Japan next week, so that'll be fun. It's always a fun one, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think you'll be busy too. Not much time for sushi when you're out there, I think. Anyway, listen, we're going to start off by taking a moment to remember F1 team boss Eddie Jordan, who passed away last week. Obviously, very much a contemporary of mine. I covered his entire Formula One career from when he came in the early 90s right the way through to when he ended. Very charismatic man, had an awful lot of dealings with him. It was actually me who started a band in Formula One called the Pit Stop Boogie Boys, and he came and joined in drumming, and we played a few gigs and I remember in the main square in Qashqai and all that sort of thing. He then ended up doing flatbed trucks at Silverstone and all sorts of other things, but yeah, had a lot of fun with Eddie one way or another. And you know, he ran a pretty good team, it must be said. They were the archetypal sort of punch above their weight team. When he eventually sold that team at Space at Silverstone, it became Force India, who were also very good at punching above their weight. And that team now is morphed over several iterations into Aston Martin, who arguably aren't quite punching above their weight at the moment, but they've certainly got all the tools coming for the future. Probably the most exciting lineup they had was Giancarlo Fisichella and Ralf Schumacher. I remember they finished third in 1999. Heinz-Harald Frentzen won a lot of races, but Bernie Eccleston once said that Formula One is a circus, and the important thing is you need to work out what act you are. And Eddie figured out that the role for him was kind of like a clown. Although he was serious about running the team, he also had a sense of humor, and he always brought a lot of color to things. And yes, he was a serious businessman. He made a big fortune in his career. But I think the way to remember Eddie is someone who made us smile more often than not. And Jake, you had a thought or two on him?
Yeah, certainly. Coming at this from, I guess, a fan's perspective, because growing up as an F1 fan, I was always a huge Jordan fan. I think I started watching in 97, and it was just those bright yellow cars, you know, little kids sort of watching the TV. Those are the ones that capture your imagination. And then you move on to 98, and it's got this, you know, big Hornet on it, and you think, and I was probably, what, five at the time. You think, wow, that's cool. They just seem to capture an imagination of, I think, a whole generation of fans, just this sort of irreverence, this willingness to do stuff differently. I think you looked at the likes of McLaren, that kind of thing, and there was sort of like this staidness about them. Jordan seemed to be the complete contra to that. So I was really, yeah, I consider it sort of privileged to have been able to watch the years where it was competitive and Heinz Harald Frentzen looked for about two races like he'd be in championship contention and then wasn't. And also it was a shame to kind of watch the team circle the drain a little bit towards the end. I think F1 was changing and there wasn't really that place for Jordan anymore. But it was always my favorite team as a kid. And I think I appreciate how much Eddie is going to be missed, certainly.
Yeah, that's a very good point you make. It was a very attractive team. I could imagine fans latching onto them. And he was a genuine wheeler dealer, Eddie. I mean, right up to the end, it was him who brokered the transfer of Adrian Newey from Red Bull to Aston Martin. He got him the deal involving the shares, a huge, huge salary in his contract. So, I mean, Eddie was very smart with the money. He used to work for the Bank of Ireland, and he also sold secondhand cars, and he used to quite often do both at the same time. So he would sell the cars from the car park at the back of the bank in Dublin and then run round the front and arrange the finance for the young unsuspecting purchaser. So he used to sell carpets in the market at Dublin at weekends, and was always an absolute wheeler dealer. Great value, and Eddie Jordan, we certainly will miss him. Well, one person who hasn't got a lot to smile about at the moment is Liam Lawson. Things have moved very quickly, as they have a habit of doing in Formula One, after two really poor performances in Australia and Shanghai. Ronald, you were part of the Autosport group on the ground, Motorsport group on the ground, who were getting the story on Sunday that he was going to be replaced or likely to be replaced at the next round. You were in the thick of it then. Take it away. Tell us the experience, and tell us what you see is happening.
Yeah, it was a crazy Sunday, to be honest. It started off on Sunday morning with all the chat about the V10 that we'll come to later on, I reckon. But then pre-race, we got tipped by a couple of people that Liam Lawson, his seat was already under threat for Japan. So I have to give some credit to our Spanish colleagues for that, first of all. And then Oleg Karpov and myself, who were underground, we were chasing it in the paddock. And basically pre-race, even chasing people on the grid. Normally you're there to get some pictures and walk around, but now I was really actively trying to chase people and try to get it confirmed. So then during the race, which means I still need to watch some parts of it back, because we were flat out writing the story on Liam Lawson and Yuki Tsunoda, which we got ready by the end of the race and basically ready to go 10 minutes or 15 minutes after it. Then after that, really interesting, we had the media session with Christian Horner. And of course, he didn't deny it. And he kept saying, yeah, we have enough data. Really interesting note I found is that people specifically asked him, yeah, but Liam has been to Melbourne and to China, two tracks he hadn't been to before that he didn't know. So should you give him a fair chance in Japan and maybe also Bahrain? And his reply was, well, these guys get up to speed so quickly nowadays, so we already have a data set that is good enough to go through. So that was basically the answer he kept repeating. Also, while at the same time he said we have some kind of responsibility towards Liam, but you can explain that in multiple ways, right? You can say we have the responsibility to keep him in the seat to give him some more races, but also we have some responsibility maybe to get him out of this tricky situation. So they had enough data, they went through it, then there has been a meeting scheduled in Dubai also with the Thai owners of Red Bull. And yeah, then it became clear that the position of Liam is getting more and more and more and more difficult, with confirmation expected the end of this week of Yuki Tsunoda getting that seat prior to his home race at Suzuka. To be honest, my personal opinion is that I really feel for Liam in a way. As you said before, yes, the performances have been particularly poor. I talked to some people at Red Bull. They told me back-to-back P20 on the grid, it never happened to any driver in Red Bull racing history. So yeah, those are not the kind of performances you get away with. But at the same time, I feel whoever you put into that car will struggle to survive, basically, because the problem for me is not so much with the driver. The problem for me is the car, and even more, you're putting Yuki on the spot in front of his home crowd, which is also, I even told it to Christian Horner, in my opinion, it's also a huge PR risk, because if he gets out of a car that he's really comfortable with, the RB21 is a much more difficult car to drive. So what if he gets P20 on the grid in front of his home fans. Of course, he's delighted to jump into that Red Bull, but I think there's a grained amount of risk to this move. It feels a bit maybe like correcting, it's how one colleague phrased it, and I kind of agree, correcting one mistake with another mistake. It's a bit the feeling I get. And yeah, my personal opinion is the car is the main issue, and whoever you put next to Max will struggle. So I don't think this is a solution. And yeah, personally, I feel a bit for Liam.
Well, this is why we're lucky to have Jake Boxall Legg with us, because he's the man who understands what the cars are doing, how they work, and can put it in layman's terms for us to understand. Jake, it looks like a shopping trolley when it's qualifying at the back of the grid. Max Verstappen somehow getting a tune out of it. What is going on with that Red Bull car? Before we come back to all the human elements of this story, let's just talk about why this has gone wrong.
Well, it's because it's a shopping trolley, James. Long story short, we know that Max loves a car that's very, very on the front, one that he can hurl into the corner, and then he'll react to what the rear end does. And I think it's pretty much guaranteed that whether it's oversteer or loads of oversteer, he's going to react to that. And I think Red Bull has kind of rested on that laurel a little bit. And so what you've got is a car, or a philosophy, if you like, that one person can be very, very quick in. And ultimately, that the technical directors and everybody feel that the way that they're going with the car is, maybe compared to the RB20, doesn't have as much top-end potential, let's say, but is still something that can be very, very quick. And Max was, you know, pretty good in Melbourne, and finished a P4... right at the death in China. So clearly he can do very, very good things with it. The problem is it's very, very unuser-friendly for anybody that doesn't drive like that. And so you saw this over the last couple of years with Sergio Perez, for example. So just to sort of bring this back to 2022 and 2023, the car was a little bit more neutral handling. And let's kind of explain that. When you put the car into the corner, if the back end is sliding out, that means it's oversteering. And if the front end isn't settled and it's not turning into the corner properly, that's understeer. If you're getting neither, that's a relatively neutral handling car. And that's something that Sergio Perez really liked. And that's why he was so good at the start of 2023, because the car was very, very neutral and it was something that Perez could use. Conversely, Verstappen was a little bit, let's say, less enamored with the car because it wasn't exhibiting those traits of oversteer that he liked. As the development went on, the car moved closer to Verstappen away from Perez, and that's why you started to see that divergence, because it was suiting one driver and not the other. And 2024, let's say, was an extreme example of that. And that has continued. I think it's an analogous situation to MotoGP. So Honda, for example, for years producing a bike that only Marc Marquez could use. And since Marquez has left, nobody is able to recapture the same magic. So it's a difficult one.
Yeah, and I feel that's also, this is exactly the core of it. But at the same time, Red Bull doesn't have a choice. Because when you talk also mainly off the record to people in Red Bull, they will never say it on the record, but they basically confirm this. It's the more they are willing to help Max to give what he wants from a car, the more difficult they make it for whoever is next to him. But it's the logical thing to do, because so far Max has delivered every single year. He gave them like four world titles. So there's no, Max is basically their only hope to fight at the front. So there's no point in changing the car philosophy as long as he is there. But that will inevitably mean that no matter who is next to him, will struggle massively. And I think it's even more this year, because then we come to a second element, also a key headline in China, that Max himself said Red Bull is lacking pure pace. He called Red Bull the fourth fastest team in F1. So that makes it even more extreme, because Max is visiting the factory this week in Milton Keynes to talk about potential solutions. And most likely, that means the car will go even more in his direction and will make it even more difficult for whoever's next to him. So yeah, I think Red Bull is kind of on the road to help Max. And as long as he's there, it makes sense, because he keeps them at the top, at least in the hunt for a championship. But the big question mark is, what happens if Max will leave one day? Because then you have a car basically based on years of one specific philosophy suited one driver. And when he's gone, then basically the whole team needs to reinvent itself. So yeah, I think for now it makes sense, but Red Bull is on a really tricky trajectory, I feel.
It throws up a lot of interesting questions. So one of them, as you say, is what happens with Red Bull if Max Verstappen decides to leave either at the end of this year or at the end of his contract at the end of next year? Mercedes obviously trying very hard still in the background to get Max Verstappen. The second question then is, how attractive would it be for another team, knowing that if you have him, that potentially you have to do the same thing to get the performance? I personally, in my experience, the really top drivers can drive anything and adapt to it. And I would think that it wouldn't necessarily put a Mercedes or another team, an Aston Martin, off hiring him, because you can produce a good car, a fast car, and he will be able to get the most out of it. So that's why it's slightly confusing to me that they've gone down this sort of very specific DNA. And one of the interesting notes that came out of the weekend, it was just a little small note, but I picked up on it, was Lawson was not looking for excuses. I mean, he looked shell-shocked throughout the weekend, and progressively more and more so through till Sunday night. He knew he was like literally drinking from the fire hose, and it was all literally collapsing underneath him. He wasn't looking for excuses, but one point he did make was that he didn't get a chance to sort of test the two-year-old Red Bull cars to get a feel for the Red Bull chassis sort of DNA, to the extent that someone like Antonelli has done, who's had a hugely sophisticated program of driving the Mercedes cars and learning the tracks around the world. So proper preparation for Antonelli, making use of the rules. And Lawson, I mean, that is a point. You'd have to say if the Red Bull, Jake, has this very specific characteristic that's caught out previous Verstappen teammates, would you not have been well advised as a team to give Lawson a flavour of that? Because it's not the same car at all as the Racing Bulls that he's been used to.
Yes, absolutely. And as you say, Antonelli has had a lot of testing. Jack Doohan has also had a lot of testing with the Alpine. There is the ability to do so and the merit of doing so. It's the closest that we can get these days to any kind of in-season testing that drivers, debutants of the past sort of had and drivers today don't get. Lawson did have a couple of tests at Silverstone, but they were usually Pirelli tests or, you know, extracurricular activities rather than TPC testing. So it has been very, very limited. The thing is, I think this falls along with Red Bull's driver management theory practices, in that it's the most sink or swim approach that you will see in Formula One. And the fact that we're talking about a driver who progresses to the main team and is being thrown out of it after two races, I think that's just absolutely testament to that. There seems to be this prevailing theory that a driver should just be able to jump in and be plug and play and get on with it and get on with the task at hand. You know, damn the testing and everything else. What Lawson also struggled with is pre-season track time. Obviously, it is limited to about a day and a half per driver. But then he had that water pressure issue, I think on day two, which seriously hampered his running. So it's just been kind of this snowballing effect of not being given enough time and everything kind of being geared up towards testing and him not getting that time. And so he's in a car that he's completely uncomfortable with, unfamiliar with, and he's watching the team that he left last year have a car that was really, you know, quite benign and really kind of easy to drive. So it's just this sort of almost a comedy of errors, really. And it's just same old Red Bull going through the same issues for the last 20 years and have made no effort to kind of really change it, because they see, you know, Vettel and Verstappen have come through these amazing talents, and because it's worked for them, they feel it should work for everyone else.
Yeah, there's one element I'd like to pick up on is what Jake said about Red Bull dealing with drivers and the pressure they put on them. I go back to the paddock on Saturday when we talked to Liam. And he told us, yeah, I know I need one thing, I need more time, but I know I don't get more time. So after he gave us that quote, I went to Dr. Helmut Marko. I told Marko, yeah, Liam just said, I need more time, I don't get it. And the reply that Marko gave me was, He is right. So, I mean, that's probably not the answer that Liam wanted to hear in that moment. I mean, I like it. I like always how completely honest, open and straightforward Dr. Helmut Marko is. But it can be brutal on drivers. And it's different to other Formula One teams and junior programs. If you compare Red Bull with how Mercedes does it with Antonelli, it's completely different. We talked about it on this podcast before, that Toto said in Monza when they presented Antonelli, they said, yeah, 5 minutes after Lewis made clear that he will join Ferrari, I already made up my mind and decided to go with Antonelli, which of course is not true because they kept talking to Max. But Toto says all these kind of things to protect Kimi and to give him the time. And that's completely different from how Red Bull is managing drivers. And also, I think if we zoom out a little bit after this decision again, just imagine you are a young karting talent. You're like a massive talent and all the F1 teams are coming to you. Do you want to join the Red Bull program? Do you want to join the Ferrari program? Do you want to join the Mercedes program? Then probably young kids will look at it and think, wait, if I go to the Red Bull program, they might give me a chance in F1 quickly, but also they might burn my career and might kick me out after two races again. So I think Red Bull program, as Jake pointed out, has been massively successful, but especially with how they treat the drivers next to Max, I think that's something they have to be a bit careful with and keep in mind also if they want to attract young talent for the future. And I think that's a bit of a risky way they are dealing with drivers at the moment, to be honest.
I know what you mean, but they have had a pretty good conveyor belt of talent. I've had a bit of a look at this as well. And it's interesting because what's happening now with Lawson, for example, I saw it as well very close up with Jaime Alguersuari, who got dropped, you know, from when I think he was doing a pretty good job at the time in what was then Toro Rosso. But you see it all the time. But they get used to it because it happens right from the beginning. So, I mean, you mentioned karting. Red Bull don't generally like the drivers to do too much karting. They like them to move on quickly into single-seaters, which is a very, very difficult and very different thing from racing a kart. And that first step there into single-seaters, that adaptation process, they don't give them a great deal of time there either. So I think by the time you reach Formula One, you're used to this sort of feeling that, you know, your next race could be your last, and that's how you sort of how you have to carry yourself. But nevertheless, it's difficult not to feel some sympathy for Liam Lawson. I'm sure that the plan here, we'll find out in the next couple of days, but the plan is not for Red Bull to drop him altogether, but to drop him back to the Racing Bulls team. And it will be, you know, hopefully he'll have to keep his dignity about him as he goes about driving. But I should imagine he'll be very highly motivated. And the car, as you pointed out earlier, is a pretty good car. Is there anything else on Red Bull and Lawson before we move on?
No, there's one thing I wanted to say. There's one thing I want to say about the Racing Bulls being a good car is that already on, I think, Saturday, when we talked to Max in the Dutch media session, he said, I'm 100% sure if you put Liam into the Racing Bulls car, he'll be quicker. So I think in Suzuka and the races afterwards, we can see exactly the opposite, especially going to Bahrain, which is a track that Liam knows very well. Everyone does. But I really think that he can be up there. He can be delivering results like P6, P8, like Yuki Tsunoda did. And then probably Yuki will struggle a lot more. So I think he won't like it, obviously. But I think it could be, for the rest of the season, it could be a good move for Liam. And it might be a very tricky one for Yuki. And one thing we have to mention is that Honda is financially involved in this move as well, which is an important factor. I mean, it makes it even more attractive for Red Bull to do so. And secondly, it's the last year of the Red Bull-Honda collaboration. So all the factors kind of align to give Yuki at least one shot at it, which he deserves, looking at his results, not only this year, but also last year. So in that regard, it makes sense, but still it feels weird that over the winter, you're looking at all the data for weeks or even months. You discuss, okay, Yuki or Liam. Okay, let's go for Liam. And then two weeks into the season, you completely change your mind again. So that's, yeah, it still remains a bit weird to me, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it's probably fair to say that and I did a sort of like a couple of pieces on this last year. I always thought that Yuki was the right choice, not Liam. I think Lawson obviously has been very, very good since he came to Formula One, but you just need that experience because dealing with a top team is not something that you can just be thrown into. You need to have that kind of mental arsenal of, I guess, what to go in with, what you're looking for as a driver. And if you've only done 11 races, you don't know what you want as a driver. You don't know what you want with regards to setup. You just sort of take what you're given and go with it. You don't really have much of a, I guess, objective knowledge of F1 as much as someone that's done four seasons. So I think obviously the cream does rise to the top, and the very, very good do eventually end up in those seats. But I just hope that Yuki can take the opportunity and run with it, because it's not going to be easy. But I think he's a fabulous driver, and he's earned that shot.
It will be very interesting to see what Red Bull would do if Tsunoda qualified 20th in the Japanese and Bahrain Grand Prix, but I'm sure that won't happen. So anyway, we've thrown it forward on the Red Bull and Lawson story, and will be very, very interesting to see what happens in Suzuka next time out. Let's change gears then and talk a little bit about the team that is doing extremely well at the moment, with another win and a 1-2 finish, the 50th for McLaren in Formula One. And now both Norris and Piastri have got a race victory under their belt. It looked to me that Norris was kind of on the back foot throughout the weekend. He paid the price for qualifying behind Piastri from a strategic point of view, and the battle he had to have with Russell. But he showed, again, some strong aggression. Meanwhile, Piastri was really struggled last year in China. And you could see the growth of the Grand Prix driver there from 24 to 25. He called it his most complete weekend, and it certainly looked that way. I think it's obviously very significant for his championship challenge. Everyone's been talking about Norris for the championship this year, but I think this was an important weekend for Piastri's championship challenge. And Ronald, it's going to be quite something, this, for the rest of the season. How are you seeing it?
Yeah, basically two elements. The first one with Oscar, I think it massively underlines how strong he is mentally. Because he came from Melbourne in Australia, everything was about Oscar, and everybody expected him to be on the podium. To be fair, in the race, he was really, really quick. I mean, McLaren taught him to hold positions, etc. Then he made a mistake, but then, you know, he admitted himself, which Oscar doesn't usually do, but it was quite a mental blow, like a disappointment. But then 1 week later, to go to China and deliver your, because I agree with him, your best weekend in F1 so far, with P2 in the sprint, your first ever Grand Prix pole position, then a really impressive race. I think it tells us a lot about how strong Oscar is mentally. And then about Lando, it basically refers back to what he said on Thursday during the media day. He was in the press conference, and I was in there as well. I asked him a question about this McLaren not really suiting his driving style, because it's something that he elaborated on before. And he gave a 5 minutes long answer explaining exactly, yes, the car is quick, but it doesn't suit my driving style at all, because he explained, I like to attack in the braking zone. I like to attack corner entry. And basically with this car, I have to be more careful. I have to drive on 99%, which is against your instinct of really willing to attack. And I was listening to it and smiling in a way, because he's the guy leading the world championship, having a phenomenal car, and saying, well, to be fair, I don't really like this car. But then for the rest of the weekend, I fully got what he meant, because especially China, which is also a front limited circuit, it highlighted it massively. He was fighting the understeer. He kind of repeated what he said on Thursday, on Saturday and Sunday. I was laughing a bit on at Lando on Thursday, but I see what he means. And also team boss Andrea Stella said that, yes, this car is difficult to drive, but even more so if you have Lando's driving style than Oscar's driving style. So yeah, Australia, as you said, was a bit of a blow by immediately losing 16 or championship points for Oscar. But yeah, this is far from over. And I think he really made clear that Oscar is a guy to take more than seriously for the championship fight this year.
Jake, the McLaren drivers talked after the race about pushing each other, but also about helping each other. And one weekend could be one where one driver has a slightly better handle on the car, and the other one is able to look at the data and learn from it and raise his game, which is what happened in China. Norris learned from Piastri. It was the other way around in Australia. that dynamic of pushing each other, but at the same time learning for each other, it all sounds like super happy families and very harmonious. And obviously there will be this season, inevitably, some strained moments as there were last year. But if you can keep that going, that is a formidable weapon, isn't it, for a team?
Yeah, absolutely. It satisfies both drivers to have that situation, because ultimately, if you can manage the situation so that nobody else other than the two McLaren drivers are in the reckoning for a title, then that leaves the second half of the season or the last third of the season for them to battle it out and decide amongst themselves who's going to be champion. So ultimately, it's a situation that should benefit McLaren. It clearly has the quickest car. As Ronald has already said, it's difficult to drive and it's difficult to get dialed in. We kind of saw that with the sprint race format, after having just one practice session, it was very clear that Norris wasn't really dialed into that car as much as Piastri was. Piastri still kind of struggled with it. That's why we saw Lewis Hamilton out of the blocks just better in that specification. We've known for a few years that McLaren just likes to build up into the weekend and have the three practice sessions, use them all, and then, you know, do qualifying and be in a really good position, just sort of quietly build up through the weekend. And that's kind of a mantra that's taking through this championship as well. Just build up through the championship, try and lock out one and two. It doesn't really matter which drive order the drivers are in, as long as they don't cause any irreparable damage to McLaren's championship. Ultimately, that's the key thing. And then you have this potential for the final third of the season to be an absolute knockout. Norris and Piastri fighting each other all the way and with no outside kind of threat or anything like that. McLaren's been through that before in 2007. You know, yeah, you had Fernando and you had Lewis fighting for the championship, and they took too many points off each other and Kimi snuck in to get it. So clearly there's that learning from that year, that situation, that having two drivers and the best car. Make sure that the drivers' championship isn't in doubt first, and then go and, you know, let the drivers decide who's going to take it. I think it kind of takes the fun out of it for us a little bit, but it's a very, very sensible approach to racing.
Ronald, throw it forward for us. How do you think this is going to play out? What's your instinct tell you about the McLaren?
Yeah, well, I said before that for me, one of the biggest questions going into 2025 was how quickly Oscar would be able to make the step in terms of pure speed compared to Lando, because everyone is talking about his mental strength, his killer instinct that is clearly there, maybe even more than Lando. But we can't deny the fact that last year, both in qualifying and in the races, Oscar talked mainly about qualifying, but it was still a significant gap between Oscar and Lando. So that's something he needed to step up. And he really did. You mentioned China being a good example. Last year, he was struggling. This year, he was clearly the quickest driver. So I think it shows how quickly Oscar is learning, and if he can keep up the learning curve in terms of pure speed and combine it with the mental qualities that he clearly has, then yeah, I think he can really go a long way in this championship. At the same time, I don't want to rule out Lando or talk too negative about him, because I feel like China, all the elements came together, all the elements he didn't like, the car, the new tarmac, front limited track, a lot of understeer. So I think in Suzuka, we will see a better Lando Norris again, but that's exactly what makes it so interesting. It's not only swinging from one track to another in between different teams, but even the two McLaren drivers. So I think we've got a lot to look forward to with the team battle there.
Well, another team that's working better than I think perhaps it looks to TV viewers and perhaps in the media is Ferrari. Fred Vasseur got very upset that the TV coverage was a bit selective in the messages it chose to play. Lewis Hamilton had, in fact, suggested that as he was struggling, he should probably let Leclerc go through, despite the fact Leclerc had a broken front wing, which was really quite something. And clearly Ferrari are under pressure, and clearly Vasseur is feeling the pressure because he's been quite aggressive in a few things here. But inside, you can tell the dynamic between Hamilton and Leclerc for now is a positive one. And like McLaren's drivers, they are both pushing each other and helping each other, learning from each other. So at the moment, they realize that they're in a fight primarily to get on level terms with the McLaren. Then once they're there, things might change a little as to who's going to win and who's going to come out on top. But for now, it seems to me, looking in from the outside, as though those two very experienced and extremely fast drivers are very much focused on getting that Ferrari competitive. Jake, briefly, how far off really do you think Ferrari are in pure pace? When we get to tracks like Suzuka and Bahrain, which are more sort of typical benchmark tracks, what are you expecting?
In terms of pure pace, I did have a quick look at the kind of super time. So that's basically a metric of the fastest time of the weekend. McLaren's well up there. Mercedes is about 0.3% behind. Red Bull is as well. And Ferrari's a little bit behind that. So I think ultimately Ferrari's just a little bit off of, a tiny bit off of what the Red Bull can do at absolute peak with Verstappen, with a good setup. But equally, it seems to be a car that handles generally quite well. It's still not quite there yet, and it's still going to require a little bit of time to just dial in the changes made over the winter, get Hamilton comfortable, work out why Leclerc was so quick with a broken front wing. That doesn't necessarily bode well. So something a little bit about their aero package. But they're not too far off. They've taken a little bit of a step back in the competitive order. I think that's kind of obvious, but clearly they were planning to make some progression over the season. It just depends how much progression. I think towards the end of the year they'll be in a much better position. But yeah, ultimately they're just sort of a little bit off, and they'll be, you know, fifth, sixth, battling for those places when we get to Bahrain at these circuits that we're sort of, I guess, a little bit more used to.
As we saw last year, though, one decent upgrade can bring you right back in the game. Certainly with McLaren, from May onwards, that was the fastest car in Formula One. So things can change around quickly. Ferrari had some good steps as well last year. So certainly a lot to hope for from their point of view, that they can get themselves on terms and just keep in touch. Keeping the scoreboard pressure on is always important. That's what Mercedes and George Russell have been doing. Very consistent, very smooth start to the year, really, for George Russell, hasn't it, Ronald? He looks pretty pleased with himself, and I think he's going to be there nibbling at their heels throughout the year. That car looks like it's a good step better than it was last year. How do you see prospects for Mercedes?
Yeah, I think quite a positive surprise, at least for me, because when George did his mega qualifying lap, I asked Max afterwards, are you surprised to see Mercedes up there out of nothing, basically? And he said, no, not at all, because they have a good car and we are the fourth team. So he saw it coming. I didn't, to be honest. But yeah, I think George feels the need this year to step up. For multiple reasons, of course. Lewis left the team, so he already said it himself. He wants to grow into the role of team leader more. Still in the background, we have the stories about Max potentially joining one day. I don't want to call it a shootout between George and Kimi, but still, both of them know that they have to deliver, because they don't want be the guy going if Max will join that team one day. So yeah, I think as a team, they understood the current ground effect cars a bit more, finally, I would say, and they created a more stable package than George is taking most out of the car so far. And I'm impressed with Kimi Antonelli. I'm not sure why he was voted driver of the day, to be honest, in China, but still, I think in overall, he has done a good job. He's learned massively from the mistake that he made in Monza. So maybe that's been a blessing after all. I mean, Toto admitted it was a mistake to put him in the car there. Clearly it was. But he was trying to win the world championship in one lap, and they made very clear to him that that's not the way to go. And I think he really learned it. He is building up the weekend much better, almost like an experienced guy. So I feel like Antonelli clearly getting there, clearly learned from Monza. And to be fair, I'm quite impressed by both Mercedes drivers so far.
It's kind of a free hit in a way for them this year. And with Antonelli, that's certainly the way it's been described. Certainly not a free hit for Jack Doohan. Came into this championship with a lot of pressure on his shoulders, a lot of people mischievously suggesting that he would be dropped during the course of the season because Alpine has these amazing reserve drivers in Paul Aron and Franco Colapinto. What would be the point of having drivers of that caliber sitting on the sidelines if you weren't planning on using them? So if you're in Jack Doohan's shoes, it was already a difficult situation you find yourself in. Good thing to have a multiple world champion motorcycle racing father who's as hard as nails mentally in your corner to help keep you calm. But nevertheless, on track, I would say Doohan doesn't look all that calm. And it's pretty unusual for a rookie driver to get penalty points on his license in his first two Grand Prix of the season. Did have an outing, of course, at the end of last year to get a feel for it in Abu Dhabi. But this is his first proper go at it. And Jake, it's not particularly encouraging. Clearly, he feels he's got to defend his corner. But is this something that Doohan had in his junior career, this kind of elbows out, running, you know, close to the wire in terms of getting penalty points? Or is this something that you think is just a pure expression of the pressure that he finds himself under now?
I think it sort of, it underlines a little bit kind of how harsh the system is, because if you kind of boiled the penalty points collection down to what they were, it was, you know, slightly shoving Hadjar off the road, obviously, which is against the regulations and worthy of the penalty. And the other one was relatively minor contact with Bortoleto. I don't think there's too much reason to be worried. Again, it is a little bit heavy-handed. He did have a bit of an elbows out approach, but at the same time, he wasn't, you know, let's say he wasn't a frequent fixture of the steward's office or anything like that. I think Doohan's had sort of a little bit of an unfair time, because if you actually boil it down to his performance, his race pace is actually very, very close to Gasly's. I think when it comes to dealing with the late stage tyre wear and that sort of thing over a stint, maybe he's a little bit worse off, but actually race pace for a given set of tyres, you can expect them to be very, very close. Qualifying pace, again, it's a little bit of a question mark right now. Again, that was maybe something that he was never very particularly stunning out in his junior career. But again, he out-qualified Gasly in the sprint, did drop out in Q1 in China, but again, so did Gasly. The Alpine, it seems to be in a weird place, because it's obviously better than last year's car, but I just don't think they've made the most of it in the first two races. And so every time you're at the back of the field and you're a rookie driver and you're trying to prove yourself and you've got this pressure on your shoulders and you want to make something of your race, because you know that five or six P14s in a row aren't necessarily going to be the things to save your seat, you are going to take more liberties. And unfortunately, you just end up in situations like that, that he did with Bortoleto, that he did with Hadjar. I think he just needs to... There needs to be a situation where Alpine gets the weekend right, gets the setup right, and in Suzuka, with the full gamut of practice sessions, there is that opportunity. It just needs to be an environment for him to kind of thrive a little bit, because I think he's a good driver. I just think we sort of need actual time to see where he is, because the green shoots of race pace are there for sure.
Yeah, two things to follow up on that. First one, the race pace was quite good. Also qualifying pace, I think where he was behind Pierre Gasly, he was only 1/10 off. So that's really the message also Alpine wants to push and wants us to see. Like, yeah, actually his pace is much better now than it was in Abu Dhabi last year when he made his debut. And to be fair, that's a really good point. But at the same time, the pressure is ramping up, and that relates back perfectly to the whole Red Bull thing we discussed at the beginning. Because if you talk to people in the paddock, all of a sudden, towards the end of the weekend, the name Colapinto was linked to Racing Bulls. And if you talk to people in the paddock, they mainly get the impression that was fueled by the Colapinto camp themselves.
You don't say.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, it's just to put pressure on to get him in before the start of the European season. So in that regard, I feel a bit for Jack, because he is making steps, I would say even big steps, because I was watching him in Abu Dhabi and I was like, I don't know, just quite far off the pace. I know what last race of the year, difficult circumstances to jump into the car, but I really had some doubts back then. I still have them, but at the same time, I'm quite impressed with his progress. I'm just afraid that it will not be enough. And when it comes to the 5x P14 that Jake mentioned, we also shouldn't forget about the flexi wings, because Alpine is one of the teams that had to change the rear wing. And I think they suffered from it quite badly last weekend, which also doesn't help Doohan, because even if he's close to Pierre Gasly, even if he puts in clean weekends, then still people will not see it, because if it leads to like P13 or P14, it will not get you the headline. So I think he is making steps, which is good. I'm just afraid it's maybe not enough. And above all, I'm afraid that all the conditions are a bit against him, to be honest.
Well, I think we'll wrap it up there, and a perfect summation that in Formula One, you're either giving pain or taking it, giving pressure or taking it. And the whole bandwagon rolls on then to Suzuka the weekend after next. So that'll make for absolutely fascinating viewing. And thank you both for all of your inputs, Ronald and Jake. You can read all their latest news and insights on F1 on the Autosport and Motorsport channels. Please remember to make your voice heard by completing the Global F1 Fan Survey. You can find the link in our episode description notes. And to also join our fast-growing Fantasy League community. Check out motorsport.com for details. Remember to send in your comments and questions to @JamesAllen on F1 or on Twitter or X. My thanks to Dre, Ben and Jason on production. And thanks to you for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe and leave us a review and a rating. And tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We love seeing new listeners discovering the pod, and we'll be back with another one very soon.
Hi everyone, Dre Harrison here, producer behind the scenes of Autosport and the Motorsport Network. We've heard some of your feedback in regards to your podcast feed, and with that in mind, we're letting you know that we're splitting up our content going forwards. There are three new places for you to listen to all of our audio content as part of the Motorsport Network family. Now, if you're listening to us on Autosport F1, stay right here exclusively for all of our F1 content. News, previews and reviews, and weekly fan Q&As from our world-leading journalists in our studios in London and directly from the paddock. If you want more of the global motorsport scene, subscribe to our new feed, Autosport Racing, featuring analysis, news and reviews from the World Endurance Championship, the British Touring Car Championship and more. If you prefer the domestic scene for your motorsport coverage, you can subscribe to our new Autosport National podcast. Hosted by Autosport Editor-in-Chief Kevin Turner and National Reporter Stephen Licorice, the Autosport National podcast will feature rankings, opinions, the latest news and exclusive interviews from the beating heart of the domestic scene, including British GT, rallying, hill climb and the grassroots of domestic motorsport. We also have the Autosport Retro podcast. As Autosport crosses its 75th anniversary as a publication, what better way to celebrate our rich history than a trip through the archives? On Retro, we recount some of the greatest stories in motorsport, from drivers, teams, cars, brands, and more, and include sit-down interviews with key figures across motorsport history. Don't forget, we also have the James Allen and F1 podcast, with the award-winning broadcaster and journalist combining business analysis and F1 opinions, with in-depth sit-down interviews of some of the sport's biggest names, like Zak Brown, James Vowles, and Fred Vasseur. And finally, bikes are back on the Motorsport Network. Tank Slappers will be returning with Uriel Podjamont, Ben Hunt, and a new lead host, me. Hey, they can't all be winners. But we'll be giving you weekly podcasts on everything MotoGP as Marc Marquez and Pecco Bagnaia go head-to-head for the 2025 World Championship. All of these shows will be available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and everywhere else where all good podcasts are available. Thank you so much for listening and for all your ongoing support.
Hi, Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.